This is Paul Weber, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the third teleclass in the series on construction in healthcare. Today we bring you Hazard Vulnerability Analysis for Infection Control. Our faculty for each of these three teleclasses is and has been Andy Streifel. Andy is the sort of human perpetual motion machine. He juggles more projects and travels to more destinations than anyone else I can think of. He has worked with more than 3,000 hospitals worldwide to help solve environmental infection control issues. He has overseen the infection control risk assessment for at least 70 hospital construction projects. He's authored 50 articles that I could find. Anyway, you wouldn't know it to look at him from his young baby face, but he has 34 years of healthcare experience and is currently a hospital environmental specialist with the University of Minnesota. It is an honor to have Andrew Streifel back with us to give the third and final teleclass in this construction series. So from the University of Minnesota, to give the teleclass Hazard Vulnerability Analysis for Infection Control, I am pleased to present my friend, Andrew Streifel. Andrew.
Thank you. My goodness sakes. Good thing nobody can see me blush. But I appreciate the opportunity to be able to discuss with you the forward thinking that goes into vulnerability analysis is important. And as you can see on the screen, when the bridge fell here in Minneapolis, it caught us all by surprise. And certainly, these are the kinds of things that we can never expect. These are the things that, for my hospital, received 55 individuals that were on the bridge of the 120-some. We received more than any other hospital, and our preparedness is contingent on how we respond. And to preface everything, communication is key. Next slide, we see weather incidents. We see planned explosions, which help us to get ready for things. But again, my career really began blowing up a building. So it has evolved and got me involved with a lot of issues as it relates to the hospital on the right, which got hit by Charlie, a hurricane that blew out 40 windows, took a part of the roof off, and we proceeded to have to deal with mold. And some of you have heard me talk about mold management, and as we go to the next slide, we see that regardless of the types of hazards that I've been involved with, earthquake, flood, fire, and hurricanes, we certainly see water damage as a common denominator. And we've talked about mold, but we should also consider what happens to our mechanical systems. When a disaster occurs, a lot of things can be affected in those mechanical systems, especially in an earthquake. We pay a lot of attention to the doors and the structural integrity, but in reality, it may do things that were not detected, and those leaks can go on for long periods of time as well as cause a dysfunctional air handler. But as we move along, we understand, again, we hear this over and over, that in order to have a safe environment, we have to have a continuity plan, and that continuity plan goes hand in hand with an administrative control, a policy, some kind of procedural training that gives us a commitment to react, to provide the safety even under extenuating circumstances. And largely we do this through engineering controls. Our buildings, especially healthcare buildings, have a lot of electronics, have a lot of ventilation issues, have a lot of plumbing issues that need to be dealt with. And of course, our goal is for cleanliness, because if we can't keep our patients clean, we have to deal with the infection. And of course, when we lose our water in a disaster, this becomes a real challenge for us. And that truly is something that needs to be discussed ahead of time, as well as how do we deal with that contaminated patient. If we look at our risk assessment administrative issues, on the next slide, we see a need to consider what life safety issues there should be if we have a disaster. And why that's important, of course, is because patients are there 24/7. And when we have patients, it's our responsibility to be able to deal with that. And part of that issue related to those life safety codes, we also stress the fact that we have National Fire Protection, which includes a statute called 99 in the states, or 1600, which is really a standard on disaster emergency management and business continuity programs. And so the fire folks are really the folks who push this in many respects initially, because fire code is really the boss code in our institutions. Then when in the United States, we have the Centers for Medicare Services, which are our funding source, and those folks are governed by authorities having jurisdiction that watch over all of these kinds of programs. The Joint Commission these days is very involved with utility management and issues relating to the sanitation of the hospital, as well as emergency management plans and utility management plans. So not only do we have the fire department asking us to pay attention to this sort of thing, but we've also got some of our funding sources in the state saying that we need to be prepared for whatever issue might come along, and the authorities having jurisdiction in our respective states are those that enforce the background codes and guidelines on the next slide. The Joint Commission has an Environment of Care chapter, and in that Environment of Care chapter, they discuss a lot of issues related to those utilities, the emergency management utilities as it relates to fire and plumbing, and for those in infection control, the utility that we're concerned about are those infection control systems as they may relate to our ventilation, plumbing, or other aspects that are involved with prevention of transmission. So those are very important. When we think about the administrative issues on the next slide, we really have to look at the risks and the level of preparedness that's really realistic for our respective locations. That's really important because it really would make us think what might happen to our facility, and that preparation should be focused on those things. We can't really determine all our vulnerabilities because we don't have all those available resources. It's just not physically possible. So the administrative terms that we really need to be aware of are those that relate to mitigation or remediation. Certainly, mitigation is a prevention aspect and remediation is fixing it after the fact. And I think we need to consider both of those. If you've got sagging landscape and you're getting a pooling of or a sinking of the soil, we certainly would want to fill that in before we get that 100-year flood and bring all that water into the basement. It's truly something that we need to be able to respond to. And in fact, some facilities would consider a disaster when the flooring underneath or the ground underneath of their hospital washed away and the hospital begins to sink. I was there this morning. So it's pretty remarkable when these disasters show up. And we certainly will discuss the one I just mentioned as we move through this as a current event, if you will, because it certainly is a challenge to maintain a hospital as it's washing out underneath, and then to fix it creates all kinds of issues that need to be addressed in the form of disaster recovery. So again, we never know where it's going to happen. We certainly want to anticipate, and that emergency management framework is really a process by which we look at what is physically possible or in our climate in our respective locations. And if we have a way to plan ahead, if you're in the Red River Valley of Minnesota, North Dakota, and going into Canada, the very flat land, there's possibilities of flooding in those areas, and we certainly would recognize that as a potential. So we would want to prepare for those kinds of things, and ideally, we'd like to work together as communities to be able to respond to whatever disaster may come along, be it that 100-year blizzard or 100-year flood. Certainly, we need to have some action guidelines from the staff in order to respond. If we're running into an infectious disease event, we would certainly want people to be able to be prepared, and we will certainly talk about how we prepare to infectious diseases as this continues. And then that recovery, how do we get the business back up and running? How do we manage that with a just-in-time deliveries that we are here in the States depend on sailing trucks every 3 days to keep our warehouses stocked, and if something would happen, what would we do next? And if you look at Dilbert and his disaster recovery plan, just shouting help, as you've seen in this country, doesn't always work. And certainly our major disaster here in New Orleans is an example where we really didn't respond appropriately and we didn't prepare as well. And now we need to backpedal and try and fix it, and it isn't as easy as we thought. So as we get into emergency management, how an organization establishes and maintains a program is that process for hazard vulnerability. And we've been coaxed along by our funding agencies and the fire protection agencies, really, to be able to establish a reasonable method of doing this through an incident command system and interaction with community agencies. This is kind of interesting with our university and trying to work with our outstate campuses. Those campuses are in far reaches of our state, and working with those communities with our resources available to help support the movement of personnel, maybe that are people that can't live in their homes anymore, is an important coordinating factor. But again, this is something that's challenging, and I like to think that all civilized people are in the process of doing this kind of planning by thinking about the staffing, the communication, and of course that all-important training that's a part of the process. Emergency management, again, where do you start? I know all of you probably have your response teams. You've probably been through these drills already. These are the types of things you'd even think about during construction, as Paul pointed out. You do that hazard vulnerability. That's the reason why we're thinking through this way, because they're all pretty much related, and we need to think about the kinds of things that would end up happening. And our infection control team is very much involved with any of this kind of planning, because we need to think about a whole lot of things when we don't have perhaps even water to wash our dishes or to do proper sanitation. How do we respond? How do we deal with that? And what kind of planning is in place to be able to deal with that? Running out of water is a huge issue, and certainly one that needs to be discussed. The tool to identify these hazards, again, is available. These are chapters in books. The NFPA 99 Healthcare Facilities Handbook is available to us, as well as some other documents that have been established as guides for getting this kind of material evaluated. It's the same kind of thing, again, that I might do in doing an infection control risk assessment at a hospital. And we'll discuss that as this moves along. And certainly we want to provide evidence demonstrating you have gone through this process, because then that can become a report, sometimes incriminating if they haven't done anything. But it is a way that, again, we can review and revise plans, deal with in the next slide that probability of occurrence. We're not going to get much in the line of a hurricane in the middle of the country, even though we may have high winds and flooding. It all depends. If you sit on the bluff, it's going to be different than in the river valley, and those are, the types of things that we would think about. You can't anticipate all types of disasters, but you certainly can see some of them coming, especially in the form of a construction project right next door. And there are things that go into that deal with that risk of that construction demolition catching on fire. And that's what it's all about in preparing your facility to react. And here we run into the beginnings of this matrix. Again, these are only one aspect, and this particular talk that I'm giving here today was one that we presented, Judine Bartley and I presented at National APIC in the United States a year or so ago in Tampa, I believe. You can still find that on their website. It's a lot longer than the program that we're doing here today. We've compressed this. We went for 4 hours. You're getting it in an hour. So it certainly, there is a lot more out there, and this is very much in preparation the way we would want to think when we have a construction management going on. Technological events, what happens when you puncture a natural gas line in your facility during construction? This is a disaster. This is a response that needs to be immediate. And especially when the fire marshal says, get out of the building, evacuate, and you have people in oral surgery under anesthesia, it becomes awkward. And that certainly is something we need to think about occasionally, because in our situation, someone got on the microphone and yelled, get out of the building, and then we heard nothing else, no further instructions. What do we do with the people on dialysis? What do we do with the people under anesthesia? There has to be some guidance, and we learned the hard way when that happened 10 years ago or so. It certainly is an issue to address. The matrix, as you can see, is a grid. It has a variety of natural disasters to look at, and certainly
we can anticipate a lot of these natural disasters. It's just that when is it that that the natural disaster becomes a huge thing, and that certainly has been a challenge for all of us in realizing what's might come next. I mean, we would have never ever dreamed a bridge would fall. I drove underneath of that bridge two times on that particular day, so it's it does become a little amazing that these sorts of things happen, and we certainly can deal with the natural events, but we also should consider how we would react to some of those technological events that may also occur under unknown circumstances, and I think then again, that's the kind of stuff that we're beginning to talk a lot about and in anticipation. So if you look at the probability, what are the known risks? Up here, we're going to get a blizzard. What are we doing? We get 30 to 40 inches, stuff that we've all lived through in our historical data. What we've learned from the past is certainly important to us. Unfortunately, in my climate, we've had so many mild winters in a row, we're starting to lose that memory of the events, and that's an important factor, that institutional memory, what we did the last time this happened, must be maintained in some way, and certainly those are the things that we consider in dealing with smoke, fire, and weather. We've had fires close by where we've had to shut down air handling systems in our hospital, and whoa, we can't shut down the operating room. We got 10 cases going down there, and you just can't do that. So certainly when that smoke starts, and especially if it's noxious smoke, what do you do? The training should be that we override those of us who have economizer systems. Some of you in Canada was just in Toronto within the last couple days, found out that many of your hospitals are on 100% outside air. So what do you do? How do you manage that? I can't tell you what to do today, but it depends on the events that are occurring outside. And certainly smoke and noxious odors are very important to control. You don't want them inside the building irritating sick individuals. And, of course, when that storm starts to bear down on us, our hospital was missed by a tornado by about 200 yards, so it can come close. That whole hazard vulnerability analysis, again, you need to consider risk, the threat to life or health. Again, we can't anticipate bridges falling or even terrorist activity, but we do know that if we have a disruption of a service, that we should be able to respond to that in some manner to be able to react. That mitigates, again, some of the financial and losses that might go into our community trust, especially if people don't respond appropriately and run in the wrong direction or perhaps even get out of sight. And, of course, we know that we've already talked about the legal issues as it relates to quarantine and quarantining individuals that might be infectious. This happened recently in the States where an individual had that resistant strain of tuberculosis, and I believe they came through Canada, and that certainly created a real legal issue on the quarantine of an individual like that, and that's an important also, especially with the emerging infectious disease considerations that we've discussed so many times in the past. Issues related to preparedness, again, what are your current plans? What can you think of off the wall that might actually happen, judging from what we see around the world, or bridges falling, or I know what happened in Montreal, a bridge fell last year. So it certainly does happen, and training, communicating is an important factor. I don't deal with insurance. Many institutions are self-insured, so we do certainly need to be there. One of the things that I think will happen, and I think you may have seen, especially those of you in Toronto, that a lot of your backup systems will be volunteers or redundancy. We certainly do have redundant air handling. We certainly do have a lot of that stuff available, but we also need to consider those volunteers from the community that can assist. We really need to consider that. And when it comes to flooding, it certainly is a major factor here. Grand Forks up in the Red River Valley many years ago certainly did get a big hit with water damage, and some of the hospitals and nursing homes that were in that floodplain had to be abandoned, had to be moved out of, and that was very devastating to the residents, and their well-being as they were upheaved, if you will, and moved about. So it certainly does happen, and it happens in a lot of places where there's flood. I've seen incredible pictures from the New Orleans experience, and when water starts to come in like that, it truly is a very important to respond or to be prepared and how to deal with it. So again, we look at those historical data. If we have the experience, the historical background, we can understand what worked and what didn't. We certainly do our fire drills, but that evacuation consideration is a very difficult one. We do get bomb threats. We do get very strange powders showing up, especially some years ago, and how we responded to that was really quite mixed. But now we have different teams and hazard response teams for a campus, a large campus like I'm at, that might be appropriate. But for some of your long-term care and smaller hospitals, we may be seeing people come to us from other places that we need to respond to. But we need to think about how to go about that type of thing, and certainly influenza surge has been on people's minds and now seems to have moved to the back burner, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be prepared to deal with that. As we look at our buildings, we certainly want to know how things work, whether or not the fire extinguishers are in place, that we routinely look at them. Certainly the fire marshal comes through. And healthcare facilities, of course, are probably the most scrutinized. So as we get into the practical issues for HVA, training is really always a first suggestion. It's important to make sure we know how to get out of the building. We certainly make sure we know how to take care of the patients or what to respond when a fire or smoke starts. And these are things that we practice on a regular basis, and that's very important from our point of view in infection control in particular, because as the weird thing starts to happen, we do need to be able to respond. And in my facility, some of the more common things are sewers overflowing, and the training we get on sanitation is really important for them to know what to do in the intensive care unit as water starts coming out of the toilet. And certainly that happens. It happens at my place and many of yours as the sewers back up. And we need to be able to react so we know when to shut off electrical circuits and that sort of thing. When we look at the biological emergencies and planning, we need to consider assessment and communication. Again, it's an unusual symptom in a patient. We've gone through this so many times in the past. I'm sure we don't need to spend time talking about it here, but yet the communicable disease plan should really be very much a part of any emergency preparedness plan, and that has a very important consideration. We have our urgent care clinics that might be seeing patients, and we certainly do need to consider what we can do for containment, and that containment is very much similar to what we do in construction to contain projects, like the one I saw today where the floor fell away 4 inches in the surgery suites, and now they have to jack the floors up to get their surgery suites back up and running while they're doing surgery close by. So we certainly do run into weird situations, but as we communicate and deal with whatever issue might be at hand, it becomes important to understand how that physical plant interfaces with whatever we're concerned about. We certainly need to consider if there is an infectious disease event that we need to protect our hospital from the surge of people in my country because they're not insured and maybe running to the hospital to see if their sniffle is actually something. We would have the queue out the door, perhaps, that would really inhibit our ability to treat patients. So those contingencies on how to protect the hospital by limiting the access becomes important, and certainly that's a possibility where we can't even let people out. It certainly happens here when we have a snowstorm. People stay in the hospital for extended periods of time, and that really taxes a lot of supplies as well as our ability to follow protocols for infection control. So certainly that's important. Capacity in the name of this surge, pick a number and plan. Pharmaceuticals, this whole just-in-time planning that we have is very difficult. And if we run into an infectious disease event, what is the protective equipment that we would need? Certainly we'll run out of masks. What will help us? What will be the most common sense approach to managing a facility. And, of course, how you deal with crisis counseling is very much an important part. So as we look at the mitigation, the structural, the water, and the mechanical systems, we need to be able to understand how they work, how that fire protection system might be affected in a power outage, what our water systems are, how they are affected. In the case of the hospital where the floor washed away underneath the slab on grade operating rooms, their plumbing separated and sewage went into the groundwater or into the ground underneath of that hospital and helped wash it out. So the smells and the concerns for potential infection control issues is very great. So under how we understand that water system and what it can do in flooding, especially if it breaks, is important because as we certainly want to understand what our building, how it operates, and those of you understand that an as-built drawing looks a lot different sometimes than what we design in the first place. So having the proper information is important, and knowing your building, that historical perspective is important. For you in infection control, you may have been there 20 years, but your building manager maybe is only 2 years old. And so all of a sudden, what you were interested or want to know isn't there anymore because someone retired or moved on. So again, it's that you need to consider what we need to think about for mitigation the short term. And this is what we see often in construction projects. We need to understand how our air flows are, how it affects an air intake. We certainly want to know how we're going to operate something when we're pile driving or in the case of a disaster when the fire starts sweeping up. I've seen hospitals in Germany at the top of a hill. What would they do if a fire started climbing up that hill in an unusual wet period, if they have that in Germany? Given what we see here in the flood and the dry periods that we've seen in my state as well as others around the country, we certainly have to be able to understand how we can operate a system under a circumstance where there's potential for a major disaster. When we organize that walk around, we do that in infection control risk assessments for construction. We look at the air intakes, what we might need to do if we lose power, can we open windows, many things that can be considered when dealing with your mechanical considerations. Structurally, we may even think in some circumstances that we need security fencing. How would we get that up in time? We do that for construction. We rely on our carpenters to give us a lot of this kind of support. We're working with our carpenters unions here to respond within 12 hours to give us some kind of building security or potentially dealing with access points, and certainly that's important. And as a part of that, we certainly think about other factors that deal with flooding or perhaps high wind damage that certainly would be important. And in some instances, like around here, we would really have to consider on campus how we would access the building and make sure that the pedestrians have the appropriate way to go. Hospital water systems. We might lose water. We have a contingency of dealing with an emergency water supply by having a well under our building. But again, that's only limited to sanitation water if, in fact, we have a crisis. We still need to consider drinking water. We still need to consider dialysis. For us, we're fortunate because not only is our dialysis water on the well, but also our laboratory water, and do we have the capacity? I worked with hospitals in North Carolina after Floyd Hurricane Floyd had to utilize swimming pools and water features for their water supply and had it trucked in until they could get their systems back up and running. So when we think about all the mechanical systems, we really need to think about the ventilation deficiencies. And as you can see in this fourplex of slides, that we can certainly have water and air handling system, which would give us odors. Even though it's not a disaster, we can discover these things during the walk-arounds, and it certainly would improve indoor air quality. And when we look at preparedness, even in dealing with outside construction projects. If we don't have the filters properly installed, we will not have the kind of filtration to protect the patients on the other side. And if our exhaust and return grills fill with lint, as you see, we're not going to remove that contamination from that area. And, of course, if we get water damage and we get the insulation wet, it can develop the biofilm in this fan coil, and that, too, can create a problem. We have a tendency to respond with filters. Portable filters have been a way that we enhance ventilation. It's worth talking about, especially as it relates to infectious disease events or even construction management. So we can enhance our ventilation with the use of portable filters. It is important, but yet in a event we go to continuous usage, we may create some air pressure imbalances, which can cause real problems with incursion of moisture or even contamination from the outside. So those are some of the realities that of utilization. Likewise, if you put a HEPA filter in storage, it has a tendency to gather an odor, and that odor would make a lot of people concerned if they didn't know what happened. So we have to have contingencies, and the portable filter allows us to have some, especially as it relates to an infectious disease event. And as you can see in the pictures, our first portable filter was picked up in about 1980 as a way of mitigating, or at least remediating, I guess would be a better term, our aspergillosis problem that we discovered by moving our patients into a less filtered building. The filters on HEPAs are good. They remove particles that are very small. We can direct the airflow. We certainly can get high-volume samplers. However, there are noise issues and delivery issues that need to be considered. And these are the kinds of things that we utilize in hospitals for construction. However, as you can see with Peggy in the next slide, we're validating to make sure our HEPA filters work. In this case, a project in our neonatal ICU. We want to be able to know how to use our portable filters because they too can become a part of mitigating a hazard if it involves an infectious disease. You can see here with small portable filter in the office space that once you turn them on, they really chew up the particles. The particles are eliminated, and we certainly have utilized these things for a number of reasons in our hospital to, again, mitigate concerns as they relate to odors, indoor air quality, and who knows, even capturing some droplet nuclei in preventing the spread of airborne spread diseases, which, of course, there are not a whole lot of. But for a while, we sometimes are very concerned that the unknown mode of transmission might be airborne. Portable filters, again, there are advantages. They certainly do reduce particles. We try to encourage our hospitals in this state to buy portable filters, not only for the preparation of a problem in the future, but also as a way of managing construction. And the construction project I visited this morning, as that they're building back the floor in this 39-bed hospital, many portable filters were there. In controlling airflow as well as managing the dust in those spaces. So it's a safety enhancement, but of course it costs money, and we certainly should be able to deal with these things because we're doing a constant construction work. And if you look on the next slide, we have a picture of a booklet. That booklet's available to anyone who writes in. I've given it to Paul in the past, the address, and certainly the booklet helps us understand how to deal with barriers, and it's intended for bioterrorism preparedness, and it's a manual on methods for temporary negative pressure isolation. The same way we would isolate construction projects, we might consider if, in fact, a smaller hospital that doesn't have the resources to prepare might have to segregate part of that hospital for whatever unusual emerging infectious disease might show up. But we know that if that happens, we need to consider surge, and in the states we want to see some kind of pressure management as well as an area where we can take care of patients. But again, the realities would be that we can't have all the doors closed except if we actually close them. In other words, there aren't any self-closers on them. But we can make an area negative. And we've talked about how smoke zones are set up in a previous construction talks as part of the hospital fire protection. Hospitals have these areas, and we have planned with many hospitals in this state through the efforts in that manual to set aside parts of wings of hospitals that could be managed if, in fact, an infectious disease event occurred. This is exactly what we're doing up on one of our floors, 7 Delta, today, where we're isolating part of the hospital, a wing, if you will, that's a smoke zone, and doing remodeling. We maintain negative pressure in there. We've got methods of doing that in the next slide with either ducted systems or portable systems that where we can exhaust the air to the outside. And this might be a consideration if we're overrun by a variety of infectious diseases where we think we need to ventilate to the outside. One of the most important things we want to make sure we understand is that if we shut off the supply air, we increase the discomfort. So if we can create a condition by taking out a window like we do during construction and blow air out, we can create a negative pressure zone in that hospital. We won't get each individual room, but in that space we can keep it from getting back to the rest of the hospital, either with a ducted system like you see on the left or the other on the right. And again, these are very similar to what we would do anyway during construction. On the next slide, we see potential for creating anti-rooms. Anti-rooms can isolate parts of the hospital as part of a contingent for portable filters to be used not only in construction again, but for some event that might require our thinking of isolating for airborne spread disease. Aspergillus, construction dust, can create problems for people. A lot of that is perception, but we need to know how to create these anti-rooms. And again, the booklet is there for you to understand how we create anti-rooms like the one underneath on the right-hand side picture where we've got it as we were remodeling our lobby last year. Mechanical systems, again, how does the HVAC system respond to a manual fire alarm, fire detection, or fire suppression? Why is that important? Because we do this all the time during construction. With interim life safety, we certainly might need to turn our fire systems off under some circumstances, but we certainly need to be able to know how they work. And likewise, the maintenance staff needs training. We need to have drills. We certainly would like our maintenance staff aware of how to set up these barriers, how to manage them in an appropriate fashion to make sure that we are prepared. And by working with our construction crews, that's the practice that a lot of times we get. We certainly want to make sure what our plans are current with the training. We certainly want to make sure that our as-builts and our system alarms are in place. And by doing some routine testing, it certainly allows us to make sure that we're prepared. Part of the walk around is to make sure that your outdoor louvers are okay. In this case, in construction, you want to make sure that they're not obstructed, because if they're obstructed, they're not allowing air to come into the building, and we do want to ventilate the building. Do the adjacent structures or a landscape allow you to access the building roof? Now, that's a vulnerability, and certainly we would want to make sure that we understand the condition of our equipment, especially when it comes to filtration. We've done studies looking at air handling systems all across the country as well as in this state, and we found that one of the biggest vulnerabilities is the fact that filters are not properly installed. It's not that the filters don't work. They never were installed in the first place, so it's really important to deal with that and make sure that things are working properly. And now, as you know, most buildings have a disease called deferred maintenance. That deferred maintenance in many locations is just a plain old lack of money or a priority. And certainly we want to make sure that what we have functioning works, especially as it relates to moving air within our building. As part of the walkthrough, we want to make sure that our ducts are connected. It's amazing. I was reading some construction notes from a lawsuit that I'm looking at now, how much they described the collapsed ductwork in that particular building. It happens. Ductwork collapses. The ducts are disconnected. There are holes in the ducts. And certainly that can create problems. And if you looked at, if we had time to look at more of my slides and show you a variable air volume box full of dust, you wonder if that would be able to work properly if the time came for it to drop. And certainly that's important. We certainly need to understand how airflow moves in our building, and in some instances we want to avoid infiltration. This is something that, again, I was seeing yesterday in a deposition situation as we looked through a variety of notes from construction and the imbalance of air in that space. We would ideally like to see our hospitals with the appropriate airflow, but again, that deferred maintenance sometimes does not allow that to happen. When we look at our air intakes, the air intakes are an important vulnerability. We certainly want to make sure that they're up and away. The lower they are to the ground, the better the chance there is of getting them exposed, and certainly extending them up is a priority and something that we have done here on campus, not only for the hospital, but for a variety of locations. And if you look at the vulnerable air intakes with the three pictures, you can see that you certainly can get at least one of these, two of these air intakes, and the one with the car in front and that small column is actually an air intake. The rule of thumb should be that you should not be able to throw a water balloon full of formaldehyde into the air intake. Can you imagine what people would think about that odor? And certainly we would want to have it up away in any of these situations because construction certainly can affect the air intake in the Oregon Hospital in the upper left when they start pile driving and as they ripped up the road where the car is. That certainly is a problem, and we had to extend the air intake that you see on that column on where the garbage packer is in order, again, to keep it from getting affected by a construction project in that zone. Other measures, again, we want to make sure our areas are secure. We want to make sure that there are no shenanigans going on that might affect our mechanical systems, and by isolating the lobbies and mail rooms because of the powder incidents, we certainly want to make sure that we don't have those vulnerabilities for our air handling systems. So we want to secure those grills, make sure people can't lob things into them. We really want to restrict our access, and this is important too. I've seen doors propped open during construction projects. That's not necessarily a good idea. They're lazy. They don't want to key in something, and it certainly is a nuisance to me when I can't get into the job to check it out. But yet, those are the kinds of things that we need to think about, even when in times of crisis, so that people can't come in and disrupt the hospital. Restricting access again for building information, the building blueprints. We want to keep them sacred. If people can get into those places, they really can create problems. Ventilation and filtration recommendations. Again, evaluate your system. I get a lot of the NIOSH recommendations from a free book that you can get from NIOSH back in May of 2002. This is very much a part of any of the preparation literature that we've seen coming out for chemical and biological radiation agents. So again, there's a lot in there on control and how we should perhaps even purge smoke, which is a part of our fire management system. We want to keep a lot of times smoke from entering our building, and that sometimes is difficult to do, especially if your building is depressurized. And that's why we want to make sure our operators of our buildings are very well trained in order to be able to assess the ventilation systems and deal with it. One of the things that we often think about is how we would want to increase our filter efficiency in an effort, again, to make the building better, to make it a lot more clean, if you will, but that's not so easy unless we make big changes in the fans operating, though. So to walk around and say, hey, we should increase the filtration when you're already at capacity, it might really be a very important thing to put on a list. And of course, that's not as easy to replace as we think they are. Filter bypass, again, one of the things that I see happening in a lot of places that the filters are not properly installed. We need to have a way of evaluating that. And in the booklet that on the previous slides, that certainly has a method in there for that kind of evaluation. There is not an in-situ method of evaluating filters that are already installed. We've come up with one, but yet, again, it's not a consensus. And we certainly want to understand that while we have a particle filter, it doesn't do a real good job of taking out the chemicals. Additional heating, ventilation, air conditioning recommendations. Again, this is for outside excavation as well as preparedness for an event. We want low leakage, fast acting dampers. We'd certainly want to minimize outside air at the time. We may have to override some of that because in our rules we have to have a minimum amount of air. We do not know how to evaluate a building air tightness. We certainly, that would be a challenge. And in the wintertime, we certainly have an issue with our bigger hospitals, the high rises. We pull in the cold air in the bottom and it rises out top. Those are really difficult things to manage, especially if we've got some kind of chemical contamination outside the building infiltrating. As we look at the containment, cleanup, and remediation aspects, we really focus again on some of the water removal. What do we do for inspection and repair of the infrastructure? What are the things that we need to look at? There should be inventories. These are all things, again, that are generally all well planned out. It's just infection control needs to be part of that, especially when it comes to dealing with the mold and the quality testing that might be after that. What is it that we're looking for? And unfortunately, there aren't a whole lot of guidelines. We've written about it, but yet it's not a consensus. What is clean enough? And that certainly is a part of what we need to think about. The safety evaluation, again, we look at if we lose or damage parts of our building. When I followed the Northridge earthquake in California some years ago, we looked at the building people looked at structural integrity. They looked at the stairwells. They looked at so many different things as it related to the electrical systems and water and sewer damage and that kind of stuff. And it was amazing to me was that when we went into the air handling system at that large academic health center, they did not notice that the filters had fallen off the rack. And the filters were on complete bypass. It was at that time that I thought that the air in the L.A. basin was truly sanitized with all that peroxyacid smog that they've got floating around down there. But again, it's an issue that needs to be thought about because earthquakes certainly can and did, in that instance, shake the filters off the rack. Water removal, again, how do we clean it up? Where do we find the water? We find it in a whole variety of places in the hospital, and it certainly we can utilize some of that water for drinking, but a lot of that water is really a part of a flood that we have to react to. And certainly how we get the water out of a building is an important part, and we see that there are lots of places where water can be accumulating. We certainly want to consider our inspection process. This is important, again, as existing condition. It's important when we think about how we're going to affect these areas during construction because we may disrupt them in one way or the other, but we certainly want to make sure by understanding the disaster preparedness, it certainly helps us better understand the construction management as it comes along. And as we take apart our gas and medical systems and the contingencies for keeping them up and running is a very important part of our effort set in healthcare. And so how we do that, I think, is all part of this planning and communication in our healthcare facilities. We try to keep our healthcare facilities ventilated. Ventilation is not only a comfort factor, but it's also a very important factor in dealing with infectious diseases. And the chart with the ventilation parameters I should be as close as possible. Unfortunately, a lot of ventilation issues are swept under the carpet. We don't like carpet either. But we certainly would want to make sure that hospitals, at least routinely, once a year or so, do a ventilation check. If you've got floods, we certainly want to consider is if the furniture is salvageable. You throw it away, the carpet gets pulled, life cycle costs need to be considered. If they're 5-6-year-old carpet, it certainly would want to get rid of it. We've had floods, sewer line floods, on food supply. Should we throw it? You bet. We got rid of that kind of stuff. Electrical medical equipment sometimes is not salvageable. We've had some air handling systems get flooded in local hospitals during heavy moisture conditions, and certainly that we can create some damage. But we also need to be aware that mold can begin under those circumstances. And even in some instances when something gets wet like ceiling tile, we allow them to dry it and paint it over as long as it doesn't grow mold. And generally we can dry things out in time before the mold will really take off. But when we find it, if we see it, smell it, we certainly want to take care of it. We don't necessarily need to sample, but we certainly need to decontaminate, clean up, and then build back if, in fact, we take the place apart. There's some quality control testing, again, that might be necessary. We certainly do that when there's heavy mold in place, but not normally unless it's a highly immune-compromised area. So the mold can be cleaned up. We do have other methods that we've talked about in Paul's classes from Weber training, but we won't talk about how we assure the quality control and testing here today because, again, there just isn't quite enough time to manage to get through all that. However, when we look at all the detection devices, the infrared capability we have today, when water comes into our building, and I do need to respond to somebody after I finish this phone call, somebody who's flooded, who needs to need some guidance on how to deal with that. And as recently as yesterday in my facility, we had a flood in one of our bone marrow transplant rooms, and we employ the infrared technology on the lower right to be able to detect moisture in our walls, along with moisture meters on the left and infrared thermometers. These are a good assembly of detection devices that can be used to find water and at least get it cut out if you can't dry it out. And it's important to do that very quickly, and the coaxing of infection control, depending on risk, certainly would allow us to move very quickly in managing and mitigating water damage in our facilities. When you look at the water intrusion algorithms, our website is available to you. There's a fair amount of information on how to react to floods. Remember, that's the common denominator of most disasters. We get water coming in, and when stuff gets wet, what do we do with it? How do we manage it? And that's a very important factor. When we have floods, in some instances, we bring in drying equipment. The drying equipment in the form of a small dehumidifier like they were using in the bone marrow room yesterday really helped dry that area out. I did not see but one area of moisture on the floor in the sheetrock when we put the infrared camera to it because they had brought in the dehumidifiers already and got the moisture down. Remember, mold spores can germinate in 4 hours, start to send their mycelia into the substrate, and about 72 hours later, roughly, give or take some, they can start producing spores. So if we can get in there early enough, drop that relative humidity, as well as the water content of the substrate they're growing on, we can control mold because if it gets under the sink, it gets real funky, as well as if the sheetrock's on the slab, like you see on the right, it wicks up and starts to grow mold, and then you get mold with your brand new building. So our goal, again, is to control the relative humidity, and in the south, this is not easy to do. In the north, it sometimes is easier, but we certainly do have conditions, regardless where we live, where mold can grow, and often due to those floods that might be coming along. And remembering that if you look at the mold colony with the two brooms, Those mold colonies need to be managed. This was in a New York City hospital. Those two fomites, brooms, are capable of spreading the microorganisms. So if we get mold, we need to think about how to mitigate its spread. And soap and water does a great job of helping to manage it, because once these kinds of colonies dry out, they fly very effectively. And as they fly about, they give us an opportunity to breathe them. That's why we like to have our people who do mold remediation be trained. We're training carpenters in the states to do that. It's a new program. It's one local, our local here in Minnesota. We're trying to get it to grow to so that other union carpenters have an idea on how to properly cut out, how to decontaminate, how to arrest in place, if you will, the mold spores. And they do that through training. And that is becoming more and more available to the rank and file as they work in our hospitals, because it is specialized. You need to have containment, duct tape and plastic, the same sort of thing we would use in bioterrorism preparedness. We can also utilize for maintaining, in this case, the diagram shows a bathroom remediation project that got very moldy because of defective tile installation that occurred at that particular facility. Very important to us, as we've been talking with the particle counters and the pressure gauges and the balancing hoods, is to make sure that our ventilation in our hospital is appropriate for what we're doing today, because there's not much more you can do with it. It's certainly, we'd have contingencies for isolating, and we do that the same way we did with construction, through instruction that we find in those planning manual that I previously had mentioned. And certainly checking our hospitals not only improves comfort for the people we serve, but also helps us to allows us to better understand our building and how we should respond to any of the disasters that may come along. Of course, if we lose power and we don't have emergency power on our fans, it becomes a different story. But yet those are the contingencies you need to think about. And when you look at the CDC Environmental Infection Control Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report, June 6, 2003, they give those ventilation parameters and guidelines for where those pressures should be. And in speaking quite a few times this year in Canada in particular, there's very much a consensus that we develop these contingencies to make sure that our ventilation is working properly and that we do have a plan in place for healthcare vulnerability. So we certainly, as we look at the summary, want to validate the existing conditions. Where are we? What are we likely to get hit by? What is our vulnerability? Is it just the fact that we could see a lot of people coming to our door? And then what should our response be in preparedness for this? Now, that's easy to say, hard to get the funding to do. In the States, we have our healthcare resources agency, and certainly they do provide some of that. But essential for all of it is to make sure that we have those communication guidelines with training so that we are prepared for any kind of an emerging infectious disease or chemical event, and we can practice this on a regular basis by source management during construction projects or floods. They both happen. They both happen to all of our hospitals. And preparing those personnel that will volunteer during the events is also an important factor in the management of any kind of disaster that may appear at our doorsteps. Well, Paul, it looks like I've got about 30 seconds left.
Perfect. Andy, thanks very much for your presentation today. I wanted to tell you, I don't know if I've told you before, when I was in England a couple months ago, I stopped in to visit one of our members there at a hospital who invited me to come and visit, and on top of the filing cabinet, on top of a pile of documents that were obviously related to construction and infection control and construction, one of your sets of PowerPoint slides from one of your previous teleclasses was sitting right on top and was obviously well marked up. So,
thank you. That's good to know.
You always give us some really practical information in your lectures. I expect we'll hear more from you in the future.
Yes.
So thanks again, Andy, for another outstanding teleclass lecture. Very well done.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to everyone for joining us either live or by recording. And until we meet again, goodbye.
Goodbye.